Good morning, and peace be with you. Welcome to the First Unitarian Church of Alton. My name is Dorothy Wilson, and I am a member of this congregation. I welcome you into the community of hope and transcendence. Here we seek wisdom beyond our own experience. Here we open our loving minds to the mystery of wonder and the moral imagination. Here we transcend the day-to-day of our lives to seek for truths, both meaningful and sustaining. Here we seek to offer a loving message that provides wholeness in a broken world. We are Unitarian Universalist. I offer my welcome to you, and in particular, to those who are first-time visitors. We invite you to fill out one of the visitor cards found in the back of your gray hymnal and place it in the offering plate or give it to an usher. We'll send you our church newsletter for the next 3 months to let you know about the programs and activities going on here at the church. We are glad you're here, and we hope to see you again on future Sundays. We have a nursery for infants and young children under the age of 5 through these doors and to the left in the first room past the foyer. At the front, we have a spirit chair, which includes activities for all ages. You are invited to go to the spirit chair at any time during the service to take an activity back to your seat. And youth are encouraged to attend religious education programs when we sing and bless our children and youth later in the service. We welcome everyone into this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. We have a couple announcements today. Thomas Cochran, his friend is moving to California. Anyone who has networking friends in California, please contact him. And from Paula LaFon, there will be a Beltane celebration next Saturday, May 6th at 4 p.m. in the church. Attendees or persons interested in the pagan group, please talk to Paula after church today or contact her on Facebook, or her contact information is in the church directory. It will be a potluck and hopefully have a maypole. We also say the word on the street is Earth Day celebration at the old bakery went very well indeed. So. We'd like to remind you that we do have a scent-free zone in our sanctuary during service, right over here. We also request that you do not sit in these pews. If you are sensitive to chemical scents found in many personal care products, you are invited to seek refuge in those pews. Essential oils are usually fine, but most perfumes, colognes, and hair products are not. We ask that you turn off your cell phones during service or set them to airplane mode, as the concentration of signals from so many devices causes problems with the sound equipment. Thank you. The worship team is looking for a couple volunteers to fill vacant positions. Please see Reverend Don or me if you'd like to serve as a worship associate.
Okay, I have a special announcement, and I don't normally do this, but this is a really kind of neat thing. Nan Adams shared a flyer during our pastoral care team meeting this week. There is a workshop coming up. It is sponsored by the United Congregations of Metro East. I want to say it's next weekend, but Nan has all the dirt on that. At Unity Fellowship, I think it's either God. There's a lot of information here. And my powers of deduction were not what I would have hoped. But what the program is it's a one-day workshop. It's from 9 to 3, and it's about intentional listening and the ministry of listening. And as this congregation prepares to go through one more ministerial transition, I know that's hard. And it's important that you take care of one another, okay? It's important that until the new minister learns who people are and what they've got going on for needs, You need to sort of be attuned to each other and to be able to listen to each other and take care of each other, and then help the new minister learn and mesh into that process. So now there's some pastoral care stuff that's pretty easy, giving rides to doctors, making casseroles and that kind of thing. But there's a different kind of thing when somebody's just lonely or hurting or dealing with some stuff, and really what they need is someone to sit and listen and just be present with them. And you wouldn't think that takes practice or training, but I can tell you that that indeed it can. This congregation already does a really good job of taking care of each other. At times, you are a little too self-sufficient. When the minister learns days later that somebody's in the hospital, you might want to work on that. I'm still a little grumpy about that. Oh, she's in the hospital? Really? Okay. ICU, no kidding. Huh, okay. There will be good-natured teasing on that measure for a while, I think. So anyway, there's Nan. Has the information. I brought the packet with me. And I believe, now let's see, our pastoral teams thus far is Nan and Marcia and Sandy and Ruth. And I think several of them are considering going to this workshop. And I believe Nan is, I'm going to put this on you, I hope this is okay, is going to head up organizing the carpool sort of situation so that everybody can get there if they want. It's like $10. It starts at 9, it ends at 3, you get lunch. It's great practice, and it's a wonderful skill to have. Being able to be present when other people are having feelings, good or bad, is very much a blessing, and it's a gift that you can offer each other. And it'll be a lot cheaper than divinity school, trust me. So, that is my announcement for this morning. We will now begin our worship with a prelude from Nicole. Thank you. I rearranged the service, so neither one of us knows when it's our turn. I'm now going to invite Michael up to offer a little chalice testimonial and to light our chalice for us this morning.
I'm going to light the chalice too?
You are. Well, I can stand here with the matches, but you say the words. Okay? Come on out. No. You got to talk first. I got matches.
Okay.
We have a private little stash of fire-making materials.
We do know what we're doing. we rehearse this lots. So. Okay. It says Michael right here. Okay.
Hang on. Because we were hoping that you were going to tell us about why First Parish is important to you, First Church.
Oh, yes. Well, I did this first and then that, but, you know, that's okay. Either way.
You tell us first, and then we'll light it.
Okay. All right. Well, I never went to a Unitarian church until, I think, 1991. I guess it was. But my predilection for philosophy it came to me a lot earlier than that. The rain here reminds me of something Mark Twain said about the Mississippi sometimes being so wide it only has one bank. When I was very young, I was interested in anthropology. I went on to get 2 degrees, my master's and bachelor's, bachelor's and master's in that order in anthropology. But even as a small kid, I was interested in that, and interested in, as it were, comparative religions. So I was, I was familiar with the flood story from my Catholic church, and I was then read about Babylonian versions of the flood story, and so on and so forth. But also, Native American religions and Egyptian religion in terms of, mummies and dragging the brain out through the nose and so on and so forth. I guess I was about 10 years old and I was at religious instruction, and I said to one of the Catholic brothers who was doing the religious instruction, I've been reading all this stuff about Babylonians and Iroquois and Egyptians and Navajos and God only knows what all. They have their stories just like we have these Bible stories, and what makes this any more true than those? He said, remarkably, he said, well, if that's the way you feel, maybe the Catholic Church isn't the place for you. It's like, it's like, wow, there you are. I mean, because I had always, I had been sort of sitting in the pews like this in Catholic Church and, wanting to raise my hand and say, but, wait a minute. However, those of you familiar with Catholic Church will recall that raising your hand and asking questions in the middle of the service is not really, recommended. But when I first went to a Unitarian church in Moscow, Idaho, in 1991, I found that, in fact, you could raise your hand, if not right in the middle of the service, at the beginning or at the end, and so on and so forth. I have been with the Unitarian church ever since, when I was moving here, I looked to the Unitarian community, and we had a recommendation that, there were some kind people who would put me up for a couple of months, Phil and Claudia, while I was looking for a house, and that worked out well. I came here, found this friendly group of people, like-minded people who like to raise their hands and ask questions, and don't... yes? You in the back. Yeah. So, and that's why I'm here, and I believe in supporting this institution, and I believe in the mission of the church, as it were. So that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, now we can let
you. If you have any questions, you can ask me later. Okay.
I get this.
Okay.
That.
Okay. We gather this hour as people of faith with joys and sorrows, gifts and needs. We light this beacon of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning, in celebration of the life we share together. Thank you.
I invite you now to rise in body or spirit and join in singing our first... Wait a minute. I'm supposed to say something. Go back. I tell you, I rearrange it and it all goes to pieces. We got one more. We have one late breaking announcement. We need a spring cleanup crew to clean the gutters, fix the window drainage problems, and to fix incorrect drainage in the back. Our window wells are full of leaves, which is causing flooding in the basement where religious education classes are happening. So, that said, let us be in the spirit of prayer. I will open this morning's worship service with these words from a colleague and my friend, Reverend Lisa Bovee Kemper. As we light our chalice this morning, I dedicate our worship service to all gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and gender nonconforming individuals, those who continue to survive and those whom we have lost. This week, we heard of challenging decisions, within the United Methodist Church, limiting the rights of queer Methodists, especially clergy. And yet, we know that it is not just within one church that rights are limited. It happens everywhere, even in our own beloved faith, though here it may not always seem so overt. This morning, we rededicate ourselves to our commitment to be a community of radical welcome. May we examine the ways we might improve and broaden our own practices of welcome and engagement. And may we always reach out to others, reach within ourselves, and reach across borders and barriers to make this welcome real. Now, come, let us worship together. Now I invite you to rise in body or spirit and join in our opening hymn, number 1008, When Our Heart is in a Holy Place. It's in your blue hymnals. Thank you. Please be seated. Now, because I've monkeyed with the service this morning, we're going to have a different schedule, and we're going to skip the time for all ages. This one time, we're going to bless the children and sing them out. We've got big stewardship things happening after in a little bit. So we're going to bless the children, sing them out to their classes now. So I invite you to join in the children's recessional, which is printed on the cards in your pew racks. I think I did print it up there. And the kids can go to their classes.
For the things in our hearts that we hold in silence, we recognize them by taking a stone or stones from the bowls as we enter or hear on the chalice. We allow the stones to bring us into awareness of those things important in our lives through thought or meditation. We then place them in the cleansing waters of this community, which includes a little bit of water collected from our annual water communion. If you have a joy, sorrows, celebrations, or struggles you wish to recognize, you're invited to come forward now in a ritual of joy and sorrow.
Let us be in the spirit of prayer. Spirit of life, God, we know by many names and by no name. We offer into your care the joys and sorrows of the people gathered here this morning. We pray for our nation and for our planet. Our planet is held together by the thinnest layer of atmosphere, and our country is held together by the thinnest layer of democracy. We pray for our leaders that they be guided by hearts filled with compassion for those who are most vulnerable, whom they are obligated to serve in our society. We pray for those who are dealing with water this week as the floodwaters are scheduled to rise and continue to rise into tomorrow. We pray that people are safe and warm and dry. We pray for those who are distant from us, whether by geography, time, or conflict unresolved. We pray for those who are sick and suffering, for those who would seek comfort and shelter, and for those who thirst and hunger, whether for sustenance, dignity, or justice. We offer all of these into the care of the divine, which we know by many names. I invite you now to rise in body or spirit and join in singing our second hymn, number 1023, Building Bridges. It's in your teal hymnal. We're going to sing it through twice.
Thank you.
Today is excerpted from a 2014 sermon by Reverend Greg Ward, an accredited UU interim minister who presently serves our congregation in Vancouver, Washington. At the end of the reading, we will enter into a time of silent contemplation that will be concluded by the ringing of the bell. I want to tell you a story about a little boy, about 7 years old, who left the table where his brother and mom continued to sit. The boy felt a sudden urge to count his money, so he pushed aside the clutter of his dresser to get to his piggy bank. It was the size of a grape, small grapefruit, shaped like a pig, and glass so that he could see how much money was inside. It was his net worth, such as it was. Pennies, mostly. He felt disheartened looking at it, realizing that was what he amounted to. He wanted to feel like he was worth more than pennies. I remember the details because that little boy was me, and the truth was I knew I was worth more than pennies. In a smaller, less conspicuous wooden treasure box hidden underneath merit badges and old detention slips lay the rest of my money. Whatever quarters and dimes I might have managed to stash away, I could sometimes find a silver dollar or two that I'd gotten for Christmas. Sometimes, if I'd managed a little discipline that month, I could even find some folding money. During this particular inspection, it added up to just about $5. Not much, but not bad either for a 7-year-old in 1969. I remember standing there over my small box of money for what seemed like an eternity. I was deliberating, the painful, sweating brow kind of deliberation. And although it may sound as though it was a financial deliberation, it really wasn't. It was a spiritual one. The choice I faced seemed anything but clear. I had gotten up and left the kitchen table where my older brother and my mom were still sitting. We had been talking and the conversation we were having wasn't finished. The subject, as you might have guessed, was about money. It had to do with how much we had, or rather didn't have. Times were a little tight for us as a family back in 1969. The particular crisis, I can't remember, but there was a long laundry list of items on the chopping block, and the tone of the conversation was rather serious. The details sort of blurred together, but this one part I remember clearly. At one point in the conversation, when my mom's attempt to convey the seriousness of her situation really came through, a deep silence fell between us. There were no more words. And then my brother suddenly got up from the table and left the room. But he returned after only a moment, holding a small box. My mom and I recognized it right away. It was his wooden treasure box of money, pretty much identical to the one I had. Inside his box was almost $14. He was better at saving his money. Both my mom and I knew what was coming. We braced ourselves. I stared wide-eyed and felt a lump form in my throat. I looked over at my mom, who appeared ready to cry. A few minutes earlier, she had a lot to say about the money we didn't have, but when he took the box and pushed it over in front of her, she suddenly couldn't say a thing. Tears rolled down her face. But she didn't do anything. She just let him push that box in front of her. It was me who did something. I got up and headed to my room. I walked over to my dresser and I looked at my piggy bank. Then I pulled out my own box of money. And I stood there. It was one of the greatest moments of deliberation I'd ever known. Calculating what was in my box, $5. Calculating what was in my heart. I stood paralyzed in my bedroom, staring into my box, trying to summon that benevolence and generosity that my brother had just demonstrated, but being unable to do so, being trapped in doubt and in fear, and finally closing the box and mumbling to myself, well, $5 is $5. Finally, retreating further into my bedroom and further into my heart. It was difficult for me when I decided to hold on to that money, but not because anyone berated me or responded begrudgingly. I don't think anyone even knew I struggled in that kind of deliberation. The part that was the hardest, that made me feel most lost and adrift, was that I couldn't even summon the courage to return back to the kitchen table. I didn't think I could follow my brother's generous example, and I didn't believe I could show up without it, so I just stayed in my room alone. It can be very confusing to figure out the best way to use money. Do we hold on to it for the concrete reassurance or security it offers? Or do we invest it in something greater than us, like relationships or community values? Even though those investments are sometimes harder to identify on our list of assets. The feeling of being cared for, part of something larger, what's that worth? On that day when my brother pushed all of his money into the family pot, that deliberation was going on for my mom. I could tell that she wanted very much to tell him to keep it, that she wanted to say we didn't need it that badly. And the truth is that we didn't. The truth is that $14 probably made absolutely no difference in our finances whatsoever. But the larger truth is that it made a huge difference to my brother. My brother wasn't giving all his money because we needed it. He was giving it because he needed us. And he was giving it because he wanted to feel part of something that he knew deep down was about love. He gave to feel that he was part of the team, part of something larger, that he contributed towards something that really mattered. My mom let him because she knew that his feeling connected to something greater than himself was worth more than $14. The money was just pennies. What it bought was priceless. I remember very well that day and the decision to hold on to my money rather than give it to my family. To this day, I can't remember what I did with that $5. I have absolutely no recollection, but I never forgot the feeling of aloneness that decision brought. When I offer the chance to go back and change that decision now, I would gladly do so. Looking back, it would have been the best $5 I ever spent.
What is the value of us? What value do you put on this religious community? If First Unitarian were no longer a going concern, what would that mean in your life? I know that for some of you, that would be a huge crushing blow. This faith and this congregation has saved lives. Unitarian Universalism offers a message of hope and acceptance, and that you are worthy of the love of God no matter what you've done, where you've been, or who you are. You are welcome here. Your personhood is all you need to be cherished and loved and respected. And yet, we as humans are human. We don't always like to do the things that perhaps we know we should. Human nature is much like water or electricity, in that it will often take the path of least resistance. Newton described in physics what I know of human nature, that a body at rest will tend to stay at rest until acted upon by some outside force. Human nature is much like a body at rest. It will stay where it is unless it gets poked sharply. I am here today to do some sharp poking. Unitarian Universalism is on the cusp of a huge breakthrough at the national level. Our denomination is grappling with our history as an exclusive institution, created initially as an association of wealthy white men from Harvard Divinity School, which is the truth, who rejected Trinitarian Christianity in favor of what later evolved into secular humanism. That original cohort was made up of the names we now look to as our formational and foundational DNA: Channing, Eliot, Emerson, Thoreau, Parker, Alcott. The legacy they left us was one of freedom and independent thought and exploration, the right of intellect to be included in spiritual experience, and the exclusion of any who did not conform to that narrow understanding of freedom. People of color were not welcomed in any role other than hired service workers in our early churches. Women were prohibited from leadership roles and expressly forbidden from ministry. When Egbert Ethelred Brown sought ordination so he could plant a church in his home, Jamaica, he was sandbagged at every turn. Even when he moved to New York and got tentative support to start a Black Unitarian church in Harlem, the American Unitarian Association promised and then withdrew financial support, despite his continued efforts to establish a church in Harlem in the Black community. He died unsuccessful, penniless, and ignored by the American Unitarian Association. This is our inherited culture. And nationally, it plays out still. In the last month, I don't know how many of you are hooked in with what goes on with UU at Unitarian Universalism at the national level, but it's been an exciting month. In the last month, attention has focused on hiring practices within the UUA that, while on paper, there is a commitment to intentional diversity, on the ground, it has resulted in an all-white supervisory staff at the regional levels. Criticisms were leveled at the power structure, which responded indelicately, and three people resigned their positions, including Unitarian Universalist Association President Peter Morales, Chief Operating Officer Harlan Lampert, and Director of Congregational Life Scott Taylor. A three-member triumvirate of sorts has been appointed to lead our association in the time between the president's resignation and when a new UUA president will be elected at General Assembly in June. That trinity of people includes former UUA president Bill Sinkford, retired Professor Leon Spencer, and Professor of Ethics at Star King School for Ministry, Sophia Betancourt. All three are people of color. Which prompted another hue and cry. There were complaints that our denomination is becoming unrecognizable, to which I say, to whom? Ruth Bader Ginsburg has become incredibly popular to quote these days. When asked how many women she thought should be on the Supreme Court, she answered 9. And when people got a little perturbed by that, she said, there have been 9 men for a very long time and nobody minded. It wouldn't be a bad idea to have 9 women for a while. And so we have 3 people of color sharing the portfolios of leadership in our denomination. And in a stroke of what will be ironic, certainly, at General Assembly, the 3 candidates for president of the UUA are all white. They're all women, which is a first, but they are all very white. They are all white like me white, like Northern European white. And that will be an interesting visual on the stage at General Assembly. So there has been some upset. There has been some pushback. One white male blogger went so far as to call Black Lives of UU a faction that had staged a coup and that his religion no longer felt safe for him. White fragility has been on display in all of its unattractive iterations. Now, systems exist to sustain and protect themselves. The system's first job is to sustain and protect the system. Systems are designed to resist change, and when change comes to one part of the system, it's like, think of interdependent web, okay? One part of the system, the whole organism convulses in an effort to resist that change. If a change is going to stay, the whole system must adjust to the new reality. And that means every part of the system has to get used to a new balance. What happened with the hiring controversy is, now you're familiar, we went from districts to regions, right? And so with that reorganization, we now have regional field staff, and each region has one person who is the lead field staff person. And the job for lead regional field staff for the southern region was posted. Some people applied. There was a residency requirement, which meant you had to live in that region in order to have that job. There were a couple of finalists, and the woman of color was passed over for the white man, and the residency requirement was waived. So that didn't go over so well. And the people of color were at their annual, there's an annual retreat for, it's called On the Journey Home, for religious leaders, religious professionals who are people of color in our association. And so when that hiring announcement was made at that conference, at that retreat, the person who'd been passed over was in the audience and said, now, would you explain to me why this is? Because with this hire, now every single regional lead position is a white person. And nobody had a good answer. Our region, the Midwest, whatever it's called, has no people of color on staff. The region that serves Ferguson has not one black person on professional field staff. The Northeast region, which sounds very white, but when you consider Boston and Hartford and Providence, certainly diverse cities, there are no people of color on staff there either. So, the community of color said, ouch. There was some back and forth that didn't go well. People in leadership said things like, well, if there should be, it would be nice if there were more humility in the complaining, and that if people were less hysterical, and of course, if people were more humble, is language used always to maintain oppression, and hysterical is historically a term to oppress women. And so then an interesting thing happened, and this happens in a lot of justice movements, in that there was tone policing, and we hear this term, and it took me a while to get my brain around it. And what that is, and I've heard it through the years doing queer justice work too, and that is, well, you know, if you weren't so angry, it would be easier to hear your message. And quite frankly, the people in positions of privilege and power, the feelings of those people are less important than the voice of people being hurt. And it is further oppression to say you must complain that I'm hurting you in a language that makes me feel comfortable. So think about that, because the community of color in our denomination is right now cranky, and with good reason. And the pushback they're getting is, why do you have to be profane? Why do you have to use that language? Why do you have to respond with a loud voice? And what we're doing when we do that is we use the term covenant to muzzle someone's pain. Okay? And we can't do that. Those in power do not get to police the way marginalized groups express pain. If it makes us uncomfortable, good. In over 600 UU churches around the globe this week and next week, leaders are hosting teach-ins on white supremacy and our role in perpetuating white supremacist culture. I want to say a word about the term white supremacist, because that's the one that sets white people's teeth on edge faster than anything else. This is the term that the communities of color have said, this is what oppresses us. And me, as a white person, I pledge to use the language that they ask me to. Okay? And it is historically accurate, because when you look at the first settlers on this continent that came from Europe, their entire culture was based on the notion that white people were in fact superior to all others. Everything okay back there? Okay. The settlers that came here after they were rescued from starving, then killed all of the brown people that they found here because they were savages and less human. Okay? So this country, this nation, this culture was founded on the very DNA of a culture of white supremacy. And so that's ours, and we need to name it, and we need to own it, and we need to be uncomfortable with it, and we need to be uncomfortable enough to work to change it. Okay? So, that is not the teaching that we are going to do. I got to talk a little bit about it today, but I'm going to stop here and I'm going to talk about other stuff. I'm going to talk about us. Us as in First Unitarian of Alton, Illinois. Us as a religious community, this group of spiritual seekers. And I'm going to talk about National Public Radio, because that's always a popular topic in Unitarian churches. I love NPR. Anyone here listen to NPR? Okay, come on. Okay. I love Terry Gross. I loved Tom and Ray Magliazzi, who sounded like my Italian uncles from Boston. I loved Krista Tippett. I love Lynn Rosetta Casper, who talks about food with the most poetic prose I've ever heard. It's beautiful. I love All Things Considered and Morning Edition. And in Maine, we have Maine Things Considered, which is kind of fun. Nina Totenberg. Oh, thank God for Nina Totenberg. Right? Weekend Edition, all of it. Right? And you all know these names. You all know these voices. I love the 4th of July when they read the Declaration of Independence. And each voice that brings me the news, and now gone Daniel Shore, they each read a line from the Declaration of Independence. Now I'm as jaded and cynical a person you will find when it comes to my country, but that reading every 4th of July will stop me cold and make me cry. When I lived in California, my local station was KQED. When I lived in Massachusetts, it was WBUR in Boston. And when I move this summer, I expect my closest station will be WCYY in Philadelphia. And yet, if I'm honest, I don't support NPR to the level I should. I chip in when I can, but I'm not committed to regular supporting, like, membership stuff, right? What I do is I skate along on other people's generosity. I rely on other people to do the heavy lifting of being regular supporters. I rely on other people to pay big bucks so that I can listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on a podcast. You get the parallel here, right? Right? We're talking about stewardship? Uh-huh. And now I want to offer some very specific words for those who are not in a position to give anything at all. And this is serious. You are welcome here. Period. There is no entrance fee. There is no price on God's grace. There is no price for universal salvation. You have worth and dignity regardless of the status of your bank account. And I need you to know that. A church is not a country club. You don't have to pay a high membership fee every year to belong. A church is where you can bring yourself, your whole battered, broken, scared, hurting self, and find comfort. This is a church where you can bring the part of you that you think is simply unlovable and know that we will honor and affirm your worth and dignity, no matter how messy or messed up your situation might be. The following message is not for you. The following message is for those who have the means to support this amazing refuge, this amazing sanctuary, this wonderful place where the head and the spirit can coexist in harmony, where we can each search for truth in our own way and in our own directions, supported by all. Now, We all make choices. So I want to talk about the choices that we make. We all prioritize things in our life. Sandy spoke a little bit about it last month when she talked about how she decided what to give to the annual canvas each year. There's the stuff you like that you need, and the stuff you like but you don't really need, and then there's, you know, all that stuff, right? So a budget is a theological statement, which sounds sort of airy-fairy, vague, theoretical stuff. So let me break it down a little bit. A budget is a statement of what you value. Thoreau once said, the price of anything is the amount of life you exchange for it. So how much money do you spend in a month on coffee from the drive-thru? Or Starbucks? Or Panera? How much do you spend each month on gas for your car? This morning I put almost $30 in my tank. How much money do you pledge to the church? When money gets tight, which line item gets cut? Cable? Electricity? Drive-through coffee or cheeseburgers? Church? We're presently 3/4 of the way through the fiscal year. Our pledging income is at 65%. Now, it's easy to skip a pledge donation to the church when things get tight because the church won't shut off your power or do unpleasant things to your credit score. But the light bill here still needs to get paid. The administrator, God bless that person, needs to get paid. Let me share with you some of the realities of our budget this year and the budget in the coming year. Robin Crane has been crunching numbers in a way that has boiled them down into something I can get my brain around. As of the end of March, we are behind in pledges. If the trajectory continues the way it's going, we are going to finish the year more than $10,000 in a deficit. Next year, for the same 3/4, we spent $94,000 and can expect the end of the year with up to $120,000 in total expenses, right? Heating oil and widgets and pencils and everything. So if I'm getting this right, that would mean a deficit at the end of this current year of somewhere between $18,000 and $20,000. Now we have, this is what my grandmother used to call the invisible money. She kept $100 in her checking account that she never actually wrote in the numbers. It was her own sort of overdraft protection system. Okay? So we've got a little bit there so we don't bounce checks, but that number is getting smaller as we go. If we end up with a deficit this year, we're going to shrink that cushion by a lot. And next year, we need to increase pledge contributions by 24,000 just to get through this year.
Now 24,000 just to do next year what we're doing this year with no improvements.
Okay, did you hear that? We need to increase pledging by 24,000 for next year over what we've got this year just to keep it even, to not buy one even extra thing than what we're doing this year. And as the UUA has recommended, if we are to get a quarter-time RE director, because if you want to attract young families, having a thriving and vibrant RE program is a good way to do that, we're going to need to raise an additional $40,000. So, Robin has created this thing, the $0 list. This is what we are not funding next year. No charitable contributions. The church will not be able to write a check to the women's shelter or a food pantry or a relief fund. We have no budget for social justice activities. We have no money for conferences or meetings for the board or for hired staff, professional staff. We have no money to help get anyone to GA, to General Assembly. Some congregations do that. We have no money for religious education supplies or equipment. That means no crayons. No crayons, no paper, no markers, no Play-Doh, no tape, no popcorn, which I understand is kind of important. Our sound system had better not break. We have zero money to fix, repair, or upgrade our sound system. Be very gentle with the microphone. We will not be able to give our administrator a cost of living increase. So effectively, she gets a reduction in salary because her expenses will go up, but her salary will not. We will not be able to do anything but make a token contribution to the UU Service Committee. We are unable to make any sort of contribution to the UU UN program. Any music beyond Nicole, and that means we won't be able to have music for special events. We won't be able to afford to buy sheet music. You're paid, you're okay. But, you know, with the stuff we're supposed to do, like, I don't know, tune the piano? Yeah, no, it's not in the budget. Not in the budget. We have no budget for books, for Time for All Ages, or for the RE program. We have no money for advertising or outreach, nothing for banners to carry. No kitchen supplies. No nursery expenses. We can afford the one person that we've got. Our safe congregations policy requires that we have two non-related, non-married adults in the room with the children, which means we've got one hired staff person, which means we have one volunteer who doesn't get to participate in worship because they're going and hanging out with the babies. Which, I mean, it's great to hang out with babies, but I'd like to think people come for worship too. Landscaping improvements, unless they're done by volunteers, we can't have them done. With donated money and equipment, yeah. We have no money to get our walkway repaired or to do any other accessibility improvements. If we can't raise pledging by some $24,000, we won't be able to pay unavoidable bills without dipping into our small and rapidly eroding reserve. So now is the time for many of us to decide if we can up our contributions somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 40%. I'll let you catch your breath. Where you spend your money says a lot about what you value. Where you spend your time says a lot about what you value. We're in tax season. Some of us are still in tax season. When we prepare our taxes, we have an opportunity to examine our values when we consider itemizing our deductions. Home improvement stuff is often deductible, as is a portion of the mortgage, as are charitable contributions. So your $15,000 remodel is deductible along with your $1,200 contribution to the church. What do we spend on leisure each year? How much does it cost to go to Disney? What does it cost to travel to the Gulf Coast and watch the birds migrate seasonally? How much do we spend eating out at restaurants? What's our cable and internet bill? Cell phone. I don't even think about my cell phone. And how much do we pledge to the church? If we say a budget is a theological statement, and we look at our personal budget through the year, we can ask ourselves, what is it that we worship? When was the last time you increased your pledge? Now, a lot of people keep the same pledge from year to year. I don't have to tell you that $1,000 this year, which incidentally is about 20 bucks a week, does not buy today what it bought 5 years ago. Costs have gone up. You could cut the cost of ministry by going half-time, but you can't go half-time on your electric bill. At least not for long. Now, I'm not saying you don't deserve a vacation or that you don't deserve a nice meal at a restaurant. What I'm saying is I'd like us to be honest about our values. If you value leisure time or a nicely remodeled home, and you're willing to put more money into that than you are into this religious community, I'd like you to just own it. We all make value judgments. In our reading this morning, Greg Ward's older brother pushed his box of treasures totaling $14 across the table to his mother, not because his mother needed the money, but because he needed the family. He needed to be a part of something bigger than himself, a community that cared for him and that would love him no matter what. Now, I'm not going to say that your pledge is not needed here at First Unitarian, because it is. But I'd like you to consider, when you fill out your pledge card, what kind of value you put on us, on this community, on these pews, on the feeling in this room on a Sunday morning, on trivia nights, on the work that we do distributing personal care products to those affected by homelessness. What value do you put on that? What value do you put on Unitarian Universalism? On belonging to this congregation, on belonging to our denomination, to our movement that is dedicated to doing the incredibly hard work of challenging our own privilege and dismantling systems of power that prevent all our members from having full ownership and participation in our faith. I cannot tell you what a rare thing it is, especially this week with the Methodists voting to not consecrate an openly gay woman bishop, and to institute a policy where they will now ask all seminarians considering ministry whether or not they are gay. And we have leadership at the UUA board level that I am as nervous, and I do not like authority any more than any of you. And I have to say that I watched the board meeting live stream last week, and I've never been more moved by the work that our people are doing to hear the anger and the hurt, to not stifle how it's being delivered, and to do their own deep personal work to become better allies. When I think about that last week and the Methodist this week, and I think about what we have, I mean, we're not perfect, but my God, we're working so hard and we're doing the right stuff. Thoreau once said, "The price of anything is the amount of life you exchange for it." So now I'd like you to take those pledge cards that were handed out to you this morning. If you don't have one, raise your hand. We will get one to you. And I want you to fill it out. If you've already submitted one, you are entirely welcome to make out a new one with a higher number. I would encourage you to move the decimal point if you are so inspired. And I want you to think hard about the number you're going to write. It is really hard, and I have to own this. This is my own class stuff. When I was in college and I was getting by on lots of student loans, and I knew people who were in a position to help, or I knew people who were in a position to pay for work, and sometimes I would work for them and I would get minimum wage, and they would complain that they wish they could afford to pay more, but they simply couldn't, and then they'd take 3 weeks and go to France. So I want you to think about where your values are and what you value in this congregation, and truly what you can do. I would love us all to reach high, but do not offer a number that is purely aspirational, because the board will make a budget based on the numbers you give. And we don't want to end up at the end of next year. You don't want to end up at the end of next year with another deficit. Yes, in the back. Sure, yeah.
Do you have numbers? Can you go back to that slide? That slide. Do you have numbers that you aspirationally would want? Because I can up my pledge, I don't have a problem with that. And I'm happy to sponsor one of those things.
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the DRE was $10,000. But get a buddy. Okay. So, but I mean, I think if you look, where's D? There's D. All right. The question, just for those who weren't able to hear, is, what are the numbers associated with these costs that we'd like to do? And I think we have a cost base, like what we have spent actually this year. Because in the last year, there wasn't even a line item for many of these budget items. So D has been very carefully tracking what we've actually spent this year. And I believe, did that paper get, was that put in a handout? Yeah, because it was a lot of numbers.
I did throw in
all right.
$1,000 for RE supplies.
All right, we had budgeted $1,000 for RE supplies, if that helps. Yeah?
And for buildings and grounds.
Buildings and grounds.
All those things, I threw in $10,000.
$10,000, which makes sense with roof repairs and gutters.
That's
and.
If we pass a $140,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is what we really need.
Yeah. We need $140,000 for the budget. Last year we had $100,000. And what happened is what it should have been was $120,000, because now we're coming up $20,000 short. Okay? We said we can do it for $100,000, but then the light bill needs to get paid. And so you end up writing a rubber check, not exactly, but quite almost. Yes, Sandy. Right.
And yet the pledge was not adequate. And the board basically said, no, you can't fund special stuff that you like particularly
right.
until and unless the pledge covers basic operations.
Okay, does that make sense to everybody?
Yeah.
So what we need realistically, last year we had a $100,000 budget and we're coming up short, should have been 120. This year we're asking for a $140,000 budget, which makes sense.
And still doesn't
include extra stuff like this. Okay? So, and what Sandy said is absolutely correct, that and a healthy boards, I will tell you that healthy boards have this policy against restricted donations. Because I've seen congregations have an endowment for their organ, right? Their big, enormous pipe organ, but the front steps fell off the building because they don't have money to fix them, okay? So if we believe in the ministry of this church, then that's what we will support. This building takes up less money, percentage-wise, of the budget than a lot of other old churches. Some places I've served in New England, they have old buildings with about 30 people in them, and their budget is taken up 60% with the building upkeep costs, at which point, when your budget is a theological statement, you ask, what is it that you worship? Do you worship the building, or do you worship church, or do you worship what happens here, right? I think at that point, you just shut down the church and call yourself a museum that rents out to a religious society, and you'd change around your 501c3 status because that has more integrity, okay? This church, the bulk of your budget goes to ministry. And that is a thing to be proud of. So, lecture done. I'm going to ask Nicole to play us some nice little music. And then in a couple of minutes, we'll have the collection plates will go around. Dorothy will introduce the collection. So, do you hear that, Ruth? Okay, Dorothy will introduce the collection, but you play us, I don't know, a few bars or something.
Hearts are warmed by the giving of time, talent, love, comfort, and our many other human resources. We each receive from this church the opportunity to explore meaning, purpose, and value in our lives. How does the financial contribution you make here reflect what you receive? How does our collective money transform those within and beyond our congregation's walls? This morning's offering will be most sincerely and gratefully received. May it be lovingly given.
Thank you.
Please join in reciting the offering blessing. To the work of the church, which is weaving a tapestry of love we call community, we dedicate ourselves, and these are offerings. I now invite you to rise in body or spirit and join in singing our final hymn, number 1028, The Fire of Commitment.
I invite you to join in our unison words for extinguishing the chalice. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. Let us go forth from this place refreshed in spirit, deepened in our conviction, and inspired by our compassion to love and serve the world and its people. The service begins when the service ends. Go in peace.